You thought becoming a Navy SEAL was hard? Try passing the Master Sommelier test. What's a sommelier, you ask? Well, stay tuned and you'll learn not only this, but much more importantly, how do you go about getting someone's cooperation when there's something big you want to achieve, but you can't do it by yourself?
If your desire is to become spiritually stronger, emotionally healthier, and relationally smarter, you're at the right place. Speaker and writer Stephanie Smith inspires and equips you to achieve these three key aims. If you're a parent, you also learn how to raise empowered kids ready for adulthood. Let's get started.
Last week, we began our dive into the Old Testament book of Nehemiah. So just to give you a little bit of a recap, Nehemiah serves under the Persian king Artaxerxes. And he is, in the Nehemiah, it says, he was the cupbearer. Now, we need to correct a misunderstanding that often occurs here. This was not a grunt job. This was not the guy who sipped the wine before serving it to the king to make sure that it wasn't poisoned. Okay. There was any number of people who would have been disposable people that could have had that position. This is not Nehemiah's role. Now, I'm not a wine connoisseur, and my circle of friends don't employ maids and butlers, much less a full-time wine steward on their staff. So I had to do some research to learn that in today's language, Nehemiah's job title would be closer to a sommelier. And the definition of a sommelier is a wine steward who is a trained and knowledgeable wine professional, normally working in fine restaurants, who specializes in all aspects of wine service, as well as wine and food pairing. And the most regarded certification organization in the United States is the Court of Master Sommeliers, which is heavily focused on the service aspect of wine. There are four levels in this court, and the top being the Master Sommelier. Now get this. This is an esteemed title that is only earned by the best of the best. You think becoming a Navy SEAL is hard? Well, there are only 236 individuals around the entire globe who hold the title of Master Sommelier. 149 of those are in the United States. You do the math on that because that's total. That's not every year that number of people are added to the roster. That's the total number of people that have ever passed the exam to earn that title. Well, in chapter 1 of Nehemiah, he is this sommelier to the Persian king Artaxerxes. And he has received distressing news about the status of Israel's political, cultural, and religious capital city, Jerusalem, which lay in ruins. Now, to be clear, it wasn't that Jerusalem had recently been destroyed by King Artaxerxes, not at all. Jerusalem had actually been laying in ruins for quite a while. It had been 142 years prior when Nebuchadnezzar II had laid siege to it again and had completely destroyed it. Nebuchadnezzar had long conquered it before then, but the kings that came in that they were allowed to rule, that Nebuchadnezzar placed there to say, I will let you rule, but you have to be loyal to me. They kept rebelling, and finally he'd had it. And so he says, that's it. I'm done. I'm going to teach these people a lesson. And he goes and he lays siege to the entire city. It's decimated. He destroys it. And he also even burns large portions of it. Well, what had happened was 13 years prior to Nehemiah getting this news, Ezra the priest, who was living in Jerusalem, had tried to get a coalition together and to rebuild the city. And so King Artaxerxes is the ruler over the city. They're still subject to him. And so Ezra's not trying to lead a revolt here. He's just trying to rebuild a city so people have a safe, secure place to live. And yes, this is the very same king 13 years earlier when Ezra is trying to do this work that Nehemiah is currently swirling, sniffing, and serving wine to. Well, 13 years earlier, when Ezra had led this coalition, Jerusalem's neighbors get wind of this, and they tattle to King Artaxerxes, and they lie, claiming that this was an act of rebellion. And they're being treasonous. Well, Artaxerxes just takes their word for it, and he commands the work to stop. And not only does he command the work to stop, but he goes so far as to give permission to Jerusalem's uppity and envious neighbors to say, hey, y'all can use military force if necessary to put an end to the work. Well, 13 years have gone by, and Nehemiah hears how awful the conditions are. So we don't know, but we can kind of guess that there's been a long period of time before he's able to get updates. And so maybe he's been thinking that it's going really well. Maybe he's thinking, hey, Ezra's got this going on, and he's going to hear a good report. But that's not what he hears in chapter one. And so when he hears how awful the conditions are, he's heartbroken. He wants to take action. He wants to make a change. But how can he possibly do that? You know, last week we looked at the truth that empathy always involves action. If there's no action, it's not empathy. There might be an emotional response of sadness or irritation or frustration or pain, but that is not the same thing as empathy. Empathy acts, period. And we saw that Nehemiah's empathy first led to the actions of sustained fasting and prayer. It doesn't really give us any details about the fasting. So was this a complete fast where he went without all food? Did he just give up peas and carrots? Does he not drink any wine as part of the fast? Does he fast one 24-hour period every week, every other day? We have no clue. We just know he fasted. We do see his prayerful prayer model in chapter one. And if you haven't already, you can download a PDF of this on my website, stephanieprisons.com. You can go to the website and download that prayer model because it's a great model of prayer and it works for kids all the way up through adulthood. Well, what happens is chapter one tells us that this distressing report came in the month of Kislev. And then it was the month of Nisan, 4 months later, when Nehemiah actually shows up and has this conversation with the king where he says he wants to be an agent of change. So chapter two picks up where the king is having dinner and the queen is there as well. We don't know if this was a private banquet. We don't know if this was like an in-house date night. We don't know if this is out in an official political setting. We don't know any of those details. But whatever it was, the king notices that Nehemiah is sad and comments about it. Now, this doesn't seem like a big deal to us today, but you have to understand in this time period, if you are a servant of the king, which Nehemiah was, you do not show up with your emotions. You keep your feelings to yourself. You show up happy. It doesn't matter what's going on in your life. You show up with calmness, with equilibrium. You show up with all of the positive emotions and none of the negative. Why? Well, the king's got enough concerns about how to run his empire. He is not to be bothered with your personal problems. So when the king comments and says, hey, I noticed you're sad, Nehemiah, this is not, oh, an invitation to pull up a chair, let's sit down and chat and tell me what's going on in your life. This is a reason to be afraid. And the Bible tells us that Nehemiah was not only afraid, he was very much afraid. He understands that this breach of etiquette can result not just in him losing his job, but his life. Well, He could have apologized at this point and he could have begged for forgiveness. But instead, he internally throws up a fast and furious prayer to the King of Kings while he boldly answers the Persian king. And he begins his answer by making it personal. He references, essentially, his hometown, the city of his ancestors. And he says it lies in ruins and its gates, which are its symbols of security and economic activity, have been destroyed with fire. These aren't gates that are just hanging on a few loose hinges. They're gone. They're destroyed. And that makes the city of Jerusalem incredibly vulnerable and not a safe place for the people that are still there. So he begins by appealing to the king's sympathy. And King Artaxerxes responds with four words. What are you requesting? In other words, what do you want? Now, I have the idea that there are four questions, and how we answer these four questions determines all of life. What do I want? Why do I want it? Why don't I have it? And what am I willing to do to get it? And I'm going to come back at another time and delve into those four questions. But the king's question is the same as that first one. What do you want? And we see in Nehemiah's response that there are three particular characteristics in how he answers. First of all, his answer is clear. Second, it's concise. And third, it's bold. So what can we do with it? How do we apply that to our lives? Well, first of all, let's look at it's clear. There's no ambiguity. There's no prefaces. There's no beating around the bush. There's no vague analogies. The king does not have to wonder what Nehemiah wants. You have to remember, again, they're not sitting down having a long, leisurely chat over dinner. This is the king. He doesn't have time to waste. He has asked a question. He expects an answer and expects it now, and it better be clear. And that's exactly what Nehemiah delivers. He says, in effect, I want to go rebuild my hometown. Now, it's doubtful that Nehemiah had actually ever lived in Jerusalem. He was probably born in Persia. But the concept then of a person's hometown was much greater than it is today. It wasn't just a place where he was born and had grown up. It was the city of his people, of his ancestors. And he says, I want to go rebuild the town. And so this was something that the king could respect. He had an attachment to, even though it wasn't where he had lived. I do want to point out here that when it comes to communication, it needs to be clear that hints are for crossword puzzles, not for personal communication. Nehemiah doesn't give some hints to the king. He speaks out with clarity. So, gals, I'm talking primarily to you here. If you want your husband to take you out for dinner, don't sigh and say, oh, I just don't feel like cooking tonight. Because he can hear that and think, oh, no problemo, we'll just have peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Or, all right, kids, it's cereal night tonight. What do you want? And you're going to be thinking, that is not what I said. Well, it is kind of what you said. If you want to go out for dinner, say, I want to go out for dinner. And then say where and what time. Life is just too short to spend energy on dropping hints and hoping somebody's going to pick them up and assemble them correctly. Save your energy for the tough stuff, because there's more than enough of that in life. So Nehemiah's answer is clear, and that's a model of communication for us as well, especially when the stakes are high. Secondly, his answer is concise. Nehemiah can state what he wants in one sentence, and that's what he does. You know, I've learned as a speaker that if you can't state the objective of your talk in one sentence, you don't have a talk. You have thoughts and ideas and information, but you don't have a message that is going to empower people. You may have a message that can impress people. You may have a message that you even enjoy giving, but that's not the same thing as having a message that empowers people. And I will tell you, that takes a lot of work as a speaker and as a writer to make that happen. And I have to give credit to my mentor and friend, Ken Davis, for teaching me how to accomplish that, not just telling me that's what I needed to do. Now, this is also a good practice in relationships, especially, again, when the stakes are high. Do the work to whittle the answer to, what do I want, to one sentence. This isn't about why I want this. It's not about how do I want to achieve this. It's just about, what do I want? Sometimes we're reluctant to say what we want because it makes us vulnerable. Or we're vulnerable already, but it exposes our vulnerability. Because what if I say, well, I want blah, 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 and the other person whose cooperation we need says, yeah, oh, that's nice, or good luck with that. Or maybe they even promise to act on that request, but they lollygag around so long, we conclude they didn't really take it seriously. So we don't want to live paranoid about our word count. You know, it's not like we want to have to walk around with a word watch, you know, ding, 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 you've reached your 8,000 words today. That's it. Any more, and your alarm is going to go off, or, you know, some needle's going to, you know, poke out of this watch and inject you with some venom that, you know, freezes your tongue for the rest of the day. We don't want to be paranoid about word count, but there is a correlation between conciseness and clarity. Now, I've had to learn this as a mom of 5 sons. They're all grown now, but they still sometimes will say to me, Mom, can you just get to the point? And they're not being rude. It's a matter of understanding. They're telling me, Mom, our minds work differently than yours, okay? You're going to lose us in the weeds by the time you go through all your explanations and your analogies and your prefaces. Just get to the point. And so there's a humility that comes when we recognize everybody doesn't think the way we do. Everybody doesn't have the same word tolerance that we do. And yes, as a rule, there is a biological difference between how male and female brains tend to work. And again, this is always on the spectrum, and it's a principle. It's not a rule for every single individual. But as a rule, females are more wordy, and that is a good thing. It's not something that we need to ever feel badly about or be condemned about. Children, especially in the aspect of raising children, desperately need people who use language and a lot of language with them. And the research just bears this out. If children do not have someone who is using a lot of language with them, it will incapacitate their ability to cultivate not only language skills, but also make connections about how things work in the world. So, ladies, well, on one hand, yeah, sometimes we need to say, I need to just be really clear and concise here. We do not need to do that from a mindset that we feel any sense of shame for our wordiness, because that is an ability and a gifting that God has given to us. We just need to be aware that there are some times that we just need to get to the point, like Nehemiah does. Now, the third aspect of his answer is, it's bold. This is no small thing that he is asking for. He's not just saying, hey, you know, I'd kind of like to have a leave of absence so I could go write my, you know, memoir. He's not even just asking to be able to go back and to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. He is asking the king to overturn his previous decision. Remember, 13 years prior, it was this same king that had said, hey, Ezra and company, y'all got to stop rebuilding Jerusalem And I'm so serious about this that I've given the okay for your neighbors to come and attack you militarily in order for this to stop. That's how serious I am. So 13 years later, when Nehemiah shows up and says, hey, I want to go back and rebuild that city, he's not just starting with a blank slate. He's asking for the king to give him up for a period of time and also to reverse his previous decision. It's a bold ask. Now, if you're a goal person like me, I'm a big goal person, you have probably heard the acronym BHAG, and that stands for Big Hairy Audacious Goal. And I know that there are people, and I think that there's a certain point to this, who look at that and say, we don't need to make all of our goals these big, hairy, audacious goals. There's something to be said for the small goals and things that a person does in their life. And we don't want to set, especially our young people, up to have these grandiose ideas and to say a life worth living is only meaningful to the degree that you have these big, hairy, audacious goals. But at the same time, there is something to be said for having big, hairy, audacious goals, to having an ask that is so big that you have to depend on God to provide for it, and it has to take something more of you than you ever imagined possible. So Nehemiah's request to go back and rebuild Jerusalem is a big, hairy, audacious goal. And this goal has been working out in the gym every day for 4 months while he's been praying and fasting. The risk to him was not just getting a no, you can't do that, go back to the wine cellar and pull out a fresh bottle. The risk in his asking this was losing his life. King Artaxerxes could have responded by saying, how dare you ask that of me? You know that I put a stop to that same work 13 years ago. This is something that I see as leading to treason and rebellion. Off with your head. But that's not what happens. He took a huge risk and he had a big ask. And if there's one thing that you take away from today's episode, I want it to be this. Have a bold ask ready when the opportunity presents itself. You never know when that's going to happen, but God can open some amazing doors. So when he does, have a bold ask ready. Maybe your bold ask is of a friend, a spouse, a child, an employer, an employee, of life, of God. But always have a bold ask at the ready. All right, my friends, we are going to wrap up there for today with our dive into this fascinating story of the book of Nehemiah. And I want to remind you, if you haven't already, hop on over to the website, stephaniepresents.com. And sign up for High Impact. That's a weekly letter where I give information and updates and just have a way to connect with you on a more personal level. And you will be able to get some information and insights and application ideas that I don't just have here on the podcast. You can also get information over there about my speaking engagements. So I do speak at women's events and also for parenting events and conferences. So go over there and check that out. In the meantime, remember this, my friend, you have an impact that is immeasurable, eternal, and irreplaceable.
Thank you for listening. Visit the website, stephaniepresents.com, and sign up for High Impact to join the mission of building spiritually strong, emotionally healthy, and relationally smart women and families. You can also book Stephanie to speak at your event and check out additional resources. Together, we can invite and equip generations to engage fully in God's grand story.